This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodl Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Okay, so I'm talking to Dr. Anthony Rushton, who works for the European Southern Observatory. So whereabouts are you based?
Well, at the moment, the ESO, as we call it, have got me based at the Onsala Space Observatory near Gothenburg in Sweden.
Okay, what kind of telescopes have you got?
Well, basically, the observatory, there are two largest radio telescopes. There's a 25-metre dish that's used for VLBI observations in the EVN.
So VLBI is very long baseline interferometry?
Yes, that's right. It's a technique we use across Europe to link together some of the largest radio telescopes to increase the collecting area and increase the resolution.
So EVN stands for European VLBI Network. So we've got acronyms inside acronyms.
That's right. It's an unfortunate acronym in an acronym. Originally, VLBI, or Very Long Baseline Interferometry, was a technique of just linking two or three telescopes together. What happened in Europe is, at the end of the 90s, a few of the observatories and countries around Europe decided to get together and form one community known as the European VLBI Network.
So what are the telescopes participating in the network?
Well, there's quite a few telescopes scattered across Europe, and now we also include telescopes from China and down in Africa. But across Europe, some of the main largest telescopes include the 100-metre telescope in Effelsberg in Germany. There's also the 25-metre telescope at Onsala in Sweden, where I work. And, of course, the famous Merlin array based controlled at Jodl Bank regularly participates in some of the EVN sessions.
The EVN doesn't observe all year round, does it? It only works for parts of the year?
No, that's what's right. It requires quite a lot of cooperation and coordination between all the different European radio astronomers. Quite a lot of the telescopes, like, for example, the E-Merlin telescope at Jodl Bank, quite often spends most of the time of the year operating independently. And we have about two or three block sessions of a few weeks where all the telescopes get together and forms this mighty super telescope known as the European VLBI Network.
So it's a very big cooperative effort, so it must take a lot of organisation.
Oh, absolutely, and it's taken quite a few years to plan how the telescope should work together. And it also requires a lot of effort on behalf of the astronomers to make sure that each of these telescopes are pointing in the same direction. So much so that we've even gone and created a base for VLBI astronomy in Europe known as JIVE, which stands for the Joint Institute for VLBI Astronomy in Europe, which coordinates all these activities and makes sure all these telescopes point together. Because if you think about it, these are some of the largest telescopes, if not the largest telescopes across Europe. You've got to make sure that all that metal and steel are all pointing at the same point in the sky.
So do they look after the data that comes back from the telescopes as well?
Yes, that's right. They not only they coordinate the schedule of where and, most importantly, when the telescope should be pointing in the sky, but it's their responsibility to bring the data back, and the huge amounts of data that is generated at each of the individual telescopes. Each telescope moves the data back to JIVE in the Netherlands. And we've now two different methods that we use to move the data back. We originally placed all the data from each telescope and recorded it on hard disks in each of the telescopes, and we just posted the data to the JIVE Institute, where we then played back the data into a supercomputer known as the Correlator. In the last few years, we've been taking advantage of the very rapid growth of the internet across Europe, and we've been linking the telescopes together to JIVE using extremely fast internet connections. So while at home we might typically have internet connections of a few tens or hundreds of megabits per second, we've had to link each telescope to JIVE at least 1 gigabit per second. So they get a very, very fast internet connection.
That's a lot of data.
Yes, precisely. But it also saves a lot on recording disks.
So this week in Manchester there's been a meeting of astronomers who use this network of telescopes. So they've all been presenting some of the exciting science results that they've been getting out of the instrument. What kind of work have you been doing with it?
Well, I'm particularly interested in black holes that live in the Milky Way galaxy. So black holes that are relatively close by to us and emit very strong X-ray and radio emission. And I'm very interested in trying to understand how, when some matter falls into the black hole, how a very small fraction of that matter can get kicked out in the form of a particle jet, which then emits radio emission. My research focuses on having a look at the very, very tiny details around the black hole, and have a look at how the particles get accelerated away from the black holes and move out into into the galaxy. And it's also very important to try to relate that those properties to how the X-ray emission, the X-ray photons, flicker and change.
Okay, so how close to the black hole can you actually get with VLBI? Can you actually see the black hole?
Well, for the very nearby black holes that we can see, we can get down to extremely close distances away from the black hole. We believe we can see radio emission that comes from the equivalent of about a few astronomical units away from the black hole, and track the radio emission coming from the particles that are accelerated up to near the speed of light, and track these particles as they move away by many tens or even hundreds of AU away from the black hole.
That's pretty close. So that's just a few times the Earth's distance from the Sun that you can see material around the black hole.
Yes, that's right. And in fact, in some of these systems, we believe we can starting to see the orbital motion of the black hole around another system. So if we have a black hole that's been fortunate enough to remain in a binary system, because of course black holes come about due to very massive stars, which when they get to the end of their lifetime, they explode and form supernovas, leaving a compact black hole in the centre of the system. If that explosion doesn't destroy a companion star that's in orbit with it, then that companion star can remain in a binary orbit, transferring matter onto the black hole. Using the very high angular resolution techniques used in VLBI, we now believe we can start to see some of the orbital motion and the behaviour of the black hole around the companion star.
So these are stellar mass black holes. These are not the supermassive black holes that you find in the centres of galaxies.
That's right. We've been starting to see many black holes all over the universe at various different scales and sizes. So we're talking about here the black holes that have about 7 to 15 times the mass of our own Sun inside the black hole. And as we move further and further out into the universe, we start to see bigger and bigger black holes. The closest very large black hole, or what we call a supermassive black hole, when the mass of the black hole is or the order of a million times our Sun, the closest supermassive black hole is, of course, our galactic centre, which seems to be the point where all the stars in the galaxy and all the gas in the Milky Way galaxy orbit around. This supermassive black hole is of particular interest to radio astronomers because, due to its relative proximity and its relative size, we believe that we, in the next 10 to 15 years, will be able to start resolving the event horizon of the black hole in the centre of the Milky Way. An event horizon comes about because the density of the centre of the black hole is so large that at that radius away from the centre of the black hole, not even light can escape from the black hole. After the black hole that's in the centre of our Milky Way galaxy, we can then start looking at some of the black holes that are in our nearby neighbouring galaxies, such as a very famous relatively near galaxy called M82. These types of galaxies are believed to have very many active regions and are populated by many black holes of a range of different masses. One of the very exciting results that was presented this week was in two of the nearby galaxies, namely M82 and a galaxy called ARP220. We're starting to believe that we can directly see the stellar mass black holes in these extragalactic sources. And because these sources are relatively small on the sky compared to our entire Milky Way, we can watch these nearby galaxies, and we can view all the different black holes all at the same time, and we can start watching the variability in all these sources in galaxies such as M82 and ARP220.
Okay, so these galaxies are very active. They're forming lots and lots of stars. And it's that star formation that's creating these black holes?
Yeah, precisely. These are very special galaxies. They're not like the Milky Way galaxy. In star formation galaxies, we have a lot of very high massive stars that are constantly formed due to various properties such as the density of clouds that are in the galaxy. This consequently creates more supernova explosions that we can observe and track with telescopes such as the E-Merlin telescope at Jodrell Bank and the European VLBI network across Europe. And with a large number of stars exploding, we get a large number of black holes populating the galaxy. So these starburst galaxies are very special because of the sheer number of extremely compact and high-energy events that are going on.
So by looking at galaxies that are further away and watching these populations, does it tell you something about the history of the galaxies?
Well, yes, precisely. The further and further out we look at galaxies, we seem to find one common feature in the centre of all galaxies. We believe that nearly all galaxies are populated by a supermassive black hole at the very centre. And that black hole in the centre of the galaxy seems to be directly related to the actual size of the galaxy that we see. So we were currently trying to understand, how does the central black hole start to form? Do these small stellar mass black holes that we see in the Milky Way galaxy and in M82, do they collide together to form supermassive black holes, which then shape the size and evolutionary history of the galaxy?
Okay, so these supermassive black holes that are in the cores of other galaxies are obviously quite a long, long way away. But the microquasars that you're studying are a lot closer. They're within our galaxy.
Yes, that's right. The galaxy, the supermassive black holes we see in our nearby galaxies are in the order of a few megaparsecs away in distance. While the microquasars that we see in the Milky Way galaxy, they're much closer, and they're at least as close as the centre of the galaxy. So they're in the order of between 1 to 10 kiloparsecs away.
Okay, so the work you were presenting at the conference was on Cygnus X1?
Yes, that's right, an X-ray source in the Cygnus constellation.
So that's within the Milky Way galaxy, that's a local microquasar?
Yes, and Cygnus X1 is actually one of the closest by black hole sources that we have to the Earth. In fact, it's at a distance of just less than 2 kiloparsecs away, making it extremely close in black hole terms.
And it's not just a single black hole, it's actually orbiting a star?
That's right, it's in companion with a binary star. And the binary star in this particular this system is a very high mass star. So the mass of the star in Cygnus X1 has a solar mass of about 20 times that of our own star, while the mass in the black hole in Cygnus X1 only has a mass of about 7 or 8 times our Sun. This has the interesting result of it being a black hole which is almost effectively in orbit of another star. And that star, because of its giant size, creates a very strong stellar wind. So a large amount of the atmosphere of that star is being blown out in all different directions. And part of that wind intersects with the black hole, forming a disk around the black hole, known as an accretion disk, which is producing the very strong X-ray emission that we see.
Okay, and is this quite unusual? Because you normally think about things orbiting black holes rather than black holes orbiting other things.
Yeah, that's right. Most black holes, such as the example of the supermassive black hole in the centre, has virtually everything else in the galaxy orbiting around it. But in Cygnus X1, we have this unusual situation where the centre of mass isn't dominated by the black hole. This has some interesting consequences if you think, therefore, about the orbital motion of the black hole around this around its star. Using the technique of VLBI and the European VLBI network, we can then have a look at this very tiny detail of the behaviour of the black hole around the companion star. We believe that the radio emission comes about from the emission that originates very close to the black hole when a jet is turned off. And by studying the X-ray behavior and what the spectrum of the X-ray looks like, we can try to understand when the jet is present, when the jet has been turned off. We've been recently having a look at some observations that we took over summer 2010, when most of the jet was turned off, giving us a very precise position, or what we call astrometry, of where the black hole actually is in the orbit around this high mass star. And we're starting to see the actual behaviour of the motion of the black hole around the star, because of the extremely high resolution. We can separate the distance of about 1 AU at a distance of 2 kiloparsecs, as where Cygnus X1 is located.
So is the star visible in other wavelengths? Presumably, well, this thing is bright in the X-rays and the radio. Can you see it in other parts of the spectrum?
Yes, you can see X-ray binaries across all the different parts of the electromagnetic spectrum. As we mentioned, it's very bright in the X-rays, which come from the mass falling very close around the black hole. It's also very bright in the radio, which sometimes comes from these very large jets that are accelerated away from them, or sometimes the radio emission that comes from just above the surface of where matter is falling onto the black hole. But we also see it in the optical bands as well. But we have problems with X-ray binaries of trying to detect them using optical techniques. There is a lot of matter in between the Earth and Cygnus X1, which we call the interstellar medium of the Milky Way galaxy. And this causes the light emission to become absorbed and scattered. Effectively, it hides the emission from the Cygnus X1. We can just about see this source using infrared observations, but this is one of the reasons why we sometimes go to the radio band, as radio emission doesn't get affected by the interstellar medium in the same ways that emission using optical telescopes does.
Okay, so what's next in your studies of Cygnus X1? What are you planning to do next with this object?
Well, we're in the process of commissioning a brand new telescope that looks at a completely new part of the electromagnetic spectrum. And I'd love to have a go at pointing this new instrument that we're building at Cygnus X1. So the instrument's called ALMA, which stands for the Atacama Large Millimeter Array. And that's being built down in Chile by a consortium of astronomers around the world based in Europe, North America and East Asia. ALMA is being placed in the Atacama Desert in Chile because it is one of the driest locations in the world. At an altitude of 5,000 metres, we can start going to higher and higher radio frequencies, up into the microwave band and even into higher frequencies. ALMA will go up into hundreds and several hundreds of gigahertz of frequency, a part of the electromagnetic spectrum that we haven't studied very well on the ground at all. The telescope itself is going to be absolutely huge. It's going to have 50 12-metre antennas up on the desert there, plus another six telescopes used for just collecting the overall emission.
So what's the reason for it being located at 5,000 metres? You obviously want to get above as much of the atmosphere, but radio wavelengths, normally the atmosphere doesn't have quite so much of an effect.
That's right. In the using the telescopes at Jodrell Bank, which operate at 6 centimetres or 5 gigahertz, the atmosphere is pretty transparent to the radio waves. So the radio waves just happily go through even the clouds that are sometimes seen around Manchester and go into the receivers of the telescope quite happily. As you start going into higher and higher radio frequencies, the atmosphere starts to become opaque. That is, part of the signal that comes from the sky gets absorbed by the water that's in the atmosphere and stops the radio waves from reaching the ground. Therefore, we need to put these new sub-millimeter telescopes, such as ALMA, up into extremely high, very dry sites where the atmosphere just becomes transparent again.
What kind of things is ALMA going to tell you about these microquasars that other radio telescopes can't?
ALMA is going to be very, very special because it can look at the different parts, the different emission mechanisms of where the radio originates from. The radio mission that we see using the telescopes as part of the European VLBI network, they typically have a look at a process called synchrotron radiation. This is a mission that comes from electrons that are accelerated to near the speed of light and emit most of their radio waves at 5 gigahertz or 6 gigahertz, and they form part of the jet, the outflowing particles that come from move away from the X-ray binary. In the higher and higher radio frequencies, as we move into the millimeter and submillimeter bands of ALMA, we start to see the emission that starts coming from the companion star. This high mass star in Cygnus X1 with its extremely strong winds that fall around a disk of the X-ray binary, the emission from the winds of the star will be seen in the ALMA bands. So we can then relate and try to understand the physics that happens of how the matter goes from a high mass star to around falls into the accretion disk of the black hole and then connects to the jet and gets accelerated away from the binary system.
Okay, well, it all sounds like very exciting stuff. I look forward to seeing the results. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.